on our audit behalf. I'm delighted to welcome Chris Nynham, who's come all the way from London. Yeah. As you all know, he's a political activist and founder member of Stop the War Coalition and served as the national officer and more recently as deputy chair, one of the main organisers of the Stop the War Anti-Iraq March in 2002, was it? Yeah. Or three. Anyway, whenever. And he's worked on a lot of anti-war and anti-capitalist literature, as well as talking in the media, and also is the author of The People versus Tony Blair, so that might be worth buying. Chris.
Thanks very much. Thanks everyone for coming. And yeah, just to follow on from some of the things Charlotte was saying, I think this idea that, you know, when we're talking about radical politics and change and the Corbyn project, that really we should kind of leave foreign policy aside, is something that does very much need challenging. And it was very clearly challenged for me yesterday by the Para Regiment, who are stationed in Kabul, where you have a bunch of soldiers sent out to, you know, occupy the country, who actually decide to spend their leisure time taking pot shots at images of Jeremy Corbyn. That's a neat little image of the way in which our foreign policy can ricochet back onto domestic politics in quite a potentially quite frightening and serious way. But I mean, if you just think about it, the way in which the war on terror has shaped, obviously it's shaped the world politics to an extent that, you know, really is often overlooked. But if you think about Britain, the massive increase in government subsidy for the arms trade and the way that then generates a certain foreign policy which has led to our, you know, backing even more series of dictatorships around the world. Just the amount of money that's been spent. I mean, the war on terror has cost at least £50 billion pounds from the British exchequer, which obviously has kind of distorted our economy in a serious way. It's also created a situation where I do actually think the military is alarmingly central to my political and public life in a way that wasn't true 20 or 30 years ago. I mean, quite often you turn on the radio and to hear discussions or watch stuff online about, serious mainstream news stuff about foreign policy, and the person talking about it will either be a general or some security expert or quite often actually someone from the security services now. You know, they've become kind of commentators on politics. And we had the situation where soon after Jeremy got elected as leader, a general was quoted in the mainstream press saying that really seriously the army are not going to go along with him being prime minister. And recently, actually, we've had the move of the military and security services into kind of opinion formation, the industry of so-called opinion formation and generating, having some kind of say over the kind of narratives that dominate our explanation of the world. There was this thing, I don't know if you heard about it, Charlotte, earlier this year, it was leaked to The Guardian that the MOD are organising a kind of think tank which was going to be mobilising some experts in philosophy, theology, psychology, and actually Cambridge University, you're Oxford, aren't you? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Cambridge University was one of the possible recipients of this of a grant of £30 million that would have been kind of, you know, used towards this sort of generation of ideas in society, basically. I mean, it was partly about countering Russian influence in British society, but more generally, it was like, you know. So, I mean, I just think there's a sense in which the military is much more central to our society than they should be. And, you know, all this is just some examples of the way in which there's been a kind of blowback from foreign policy into British society. Islamophobia is another crucial element of this, which is, you know, has been the kind of demonisation of Muslims, is largely, I mean, there's continuities there, but it's largely the product of the attempt to justify wars that you know, really were very unpopular, or at least to create a climate in which it was possible to continue these wars. So I think, you know, you cannot approach changing society, changing Britain in 2019, without actually addressing the question of foreign policy. It's just not a runner, and we've got to challenge those people who say that you can. I mean, NATO is a particularly difficult one, because there isn't really a tradition in Britain of having any kind of radical critique of NATO, which there is in some countries, actually, in Europe. But for various reasons to do with our experience, and to do with the fact that, as Charlotte says, actually NATO was basically set up by the British, by a Labour government in Britain, in 1948, 1949. And it started out as a project to try and partly keep America engaged in Europe, which was seen as part of British foreign policy. It's seen as, you know, in some quarters, I mean, Emily Thornberry, for God's sake, it's seen as a kind of vehicle for an alliance for peace, an alliance for progress and, you know, Western values and these sorts of things, and or a force for stability and security and so on. It's never been that. I mean, it was from the very start. It was really about Western power projection. It was a vehicle that was set up in order to, famously, in the words of a British general who was called Hastings Lionel Pug Ismay, just for the record, to keep the Russians out, the Americans in, and the Germans down. That was the basic frame, strategic frame of it. And actually, that's pretty much what it does today as well. Funnily enough, there was obviously a big break in terms of NATO's role at the end of the Cold War, because initially the kind of justification for the whole operation was based on, you know, the dominant assumption that Russia was the big threat to world civilization and to the West, and that therefore it had to be countered militarily and ideologically on a massive scale, and that the US quite quickly by the period in the early 50s, really, the US had decided that it was going to use NATO as a central vehicle for doing this. And the US's role was to prove itself the essential element of security against Russia for the continuity of kind of Western civilization. And that's how it worked until the end of the Cold War. Obviously, the end of the Cold War created a kind of problem for the kind of foreign policy experts. And there was actually a big argument in Washington and also between Washington and the European allies as to what to do at the end of the Cold War. And particularly European governments saw there being a kind of peace dividend. They actually did reduce military spending in lots of countries across Europe. There was some reduction in military spending in America, and there were some voices that said, actually, why don't we change tack with Russia? Why don't we try and incorporate Russia into the Western framework and try and, you know, bring them in and conciliate? That was a serious argument that was put forward by Washington. And promises were made, by the way, and this is quite an important part of the story. Big promises were made by the Clinton administration to the Russians after the collapse of the Soviet Union, that there would be no eastwards expansion of NATO, that there would be no basing of American soldiers or missiles, even worse, on countries that bordered with Russia. These were promises that were made. And they were promises that were very quickly broken, because the argument of the conciliators lost, and the argument of the hawks, particularly a man by the name of Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was Clinton's main foreign policy advisor, who was arguing for a hard line against Russia. He won the argument in the early 90s. And so you had a situation where very quickly the policy was actually to continue the kind of Russia out, Germany down, US in type approach. They had to, that involved lots of kind of rethinking because, you know, what was the ideological backing for it? It was quite important, you know, how do you justify this policy at a time when Russia can't be kind of framed as this terrible mortal threat because it had, sorry, the Soviet Union, because it had fallen apart essentially. So there was a kind of, you know, a period where it was all rather difficult and they had the Iraq War, the first Iraq War, the Gulf War back in 1991. One of the problems they had is it was quite difficult to justify that. They couldn't really find ways of justifying it to the extent that they actually pulled out before the US pulled out before they many of the military wanted them to. But quite quickly, that was kind of, as the 90s kind of moved on, those hesitancies were overcome. And a policy was adopted in the mid-90s that NATO would have out-of-area capabilities, which meant that it was no longer just about Europe, it was no longer just a defensive, not that it ever had been, but it was no longer just going to be presented as a defensive alliance. It was also had the capacity to move into other areas. And the big test for that was in 1999 when Clinton made the decision, to a lot of people's surprise, but with the support of Tony Blair, to bomb Serbia, to actually put troops on the ground as well in the former Yugoslavia. And this was actually NATO's first kind of openly aggressive military operation in 1999. And it was a kind of test run for Iraq, really, that's the truth. And it was a disaster, actually. It led to the deaths of tens of thousands of people. It led to the increasing fragmentation of the former Yugoslavia. It entrenched terrible ethnic tensions. I mean, sometimes they turn around and say, oh, yeah, but what about the Kosovo War? That was a big success. Actually, it was catastrophic. But in terms of Western geopolitics, it had the support of all the NATO countries. The US got away with it. They proved militarily capable of delivering, you know, a horrendous attack. More bombs were dropped on Serbia in 6 weeks by the Americans than were dropped on the whole of the Second World War on German cities. Credible fact, but true. I mean, it was an absolute bloodbath in Serbia. And that kind of cleared the way, to be honest, for the actually an increasingly hawkish foreign policy posture in Washington, the rise of the neocons, to a situation by 2001 when 9/11 happened. It was actually seen as an opportunity. It was seen as, oh great, this gives us the chance to do what many people in the US foreign policy circles have wanted to do for a while, which was first go to Afghanistan. But to be honest with you, the real target was Iraq, and the rest is history. So the idea that, you know, NATO is this sort of cuddly alliance of defensive kind of, you know, looking after each other is just absolutely ludicrous. And now we're in a situation where, as Charlotte mentioned, Colombia is now a kind of associate member of NATO, strangely. There's talk about Brazil. There's also talk about an Arab NATO being developed in the Middle East. So it's kind of branching out in an explicit and open way. And we've also got, in the meantime, the situation in which 13 Eastern European, Baltic and Balkan countries have joined NATO now. So there are a whole number of countries that are either trying to accede to NATO or in NATO that actually border onto onto Russia, which is, you know, really risking, for the first time since the Cold War, the possibility of great power conflict. So it's a very, very dangerous vehicle in a very, very dangerous situation. It's extremely destabilising, and it is a kind of mechanism for what I believe is an increasingly aggressive US and Western foreign policy. And I just want to end by making a couple of points about that, because there is ambiguity and uncertainty about exactly what Trump represents in terms of foreign policy, because obviously he made isolationist noises at some times during the election campaign. But I think that if you look at the record, there can be no question that although there's different emphases, actually we're seeing a much more confrontational and much more openly kind of aggressive foreign policy coming out of Washington than we did certainly during the Obama years. On Iran, extremely confrontational. On Russia, despite, funnily enough, Trump's instincts, we're much closer to a very, very serious situation with Russia. The tensions between the West and Russia are obviously at a much higher level than at any time since the 1980s. China as well, you know, clearly confrontational posture in terms of trade, but also the whole pivot to the East, where more and more US military capacity and British military capacity is being put out into the Asian Pacific as a way of trying to intimidate, surround and limit China's military ambitions. It seems against the Palestinians as well, you know, a much more aggressive and dismissive and contemptuous attitude. So it seems to me there's no doubt that this is, you know, we may not have seen the big wars, and they're very worried still about the impact, that domestic impact as much as anything that the Iraq and Afghan wars had on American and Western society. So they're not, they aren't confident enough to put boots on the ground in large numbers, but in terms of their pushing outwards, trying to find weak points in their enemy's defence, increasing the pressure on their enemies, you know, we're there. And it's important to note that in the last 18 months there's been a big and explicit shift away from what was called asymmetric warfare, i.e. fighting terrorist groups and those kind of questions, towards openly discussing big power military confrontation. If you look at the American security and strategy documents, they're openly talking now, the big problem is China, China's growing influence in the world, China's growing militarisation, and also Russia as well. So they're talking openly about, you know, going back to a situation of big power confrontation, which really takes us back to the period of, you know, the run-up to the Second World War, or even the First World War. There's kind of this horrible kind of echoes, really, from the period in the run-up to the First World War, it seems to me. So that's where we're at, which is not great, and NATO is right at the heart of that, and we have to be very, very clear with people about that. You know, this is NATO is very much rooted in that whole recalibration of Western foreign policy. I think, just to end on, it's perhaps the thing that's changed most, actually. I mean, there's a lot of continuity in Trump's foreign policy. I've mentioned some of the changes. There's another change, I think, which is very important for us to kind of get our heads around, is it strikes me that it's so open now. It's not, you know, the kind of ideological justifications that did to some extent exist for the intervention in Afghanistan, even over Iraq, you know, the some sort of coalition building that did happen around that. That's gone. You know, I mean, this is just pure macho posturing and, you know, pure power play, really. I mean, if you think of what Trump's doing with Israel, you know, the annexing, recognising the annexation of the Golan Heights, possibly moving on to recognising, to talking about the annexation of parts of the occupied territories, you know, the rhetoric over Iran, all of these things. It's like they seem to have forgotten that, you know, there is some history of trying to sort of finesse some of these interventions with at least some talk about liberal democracy. But, I mean, you know, the spread of humanitarianism and so on and so forth, those things are out the window. And in that sense, the reason I say that, I think it's quite important, is that that does mean that there's a certain vulnerability to NATO and the US foreign policy under Donald Trump. This is a man who's the most unpopular president in US history, internationally massively unpopular, he's reviled, he's a joke, he's a monster in the eyes of most people. That makes it quite difficult, really, for them to talk about kind of humanitarian interventions and stuff, do you know what I mean? And I think we have to take that on board and realise that we have quite a lot on our side when it comes to these sorts of questions. And you know, I think the crucial thing is, it's very important that we've got a Labour leader who stands against all these policies. This is both a step forward in its own, a massive step forward in its own right, and also actually a product of anti-war campaigning and anti-war protesting over the last couple of decades, where he was one of the main figureheads, obviously. And this is a huge, huge gain, but it's something we have to build on. And I think, you know, Charlotte's absolutely right to say, you know, it's a big ask, even if when we get them in, actually delivering on the foreign policy things will be the hardest bit. It will be the bit the British state is most resistant to. It will be the bit where, you know, generals will complain. Maybe there will be mutinies. Who knows? I mean, you know, you can imagine. And talk about coming out of NATO. That will be, I mean, we've seen a lot of, we've seen a kind of, virtually a kind of slow coup taking place, attempted slow coup taking place against Jeremy Corbyn. If that, we move to that kind of situation, you know, what has happened up to now would be like a tea party, in my opinion. And that means to me that one of the most important strategic priorities is to keep the anti-war movement mobilised. To be able to be in a situation where if, I mean, if another war happens, we need to mobilise, but and we need to mobilise anyway. But if we did get a Labour government, the ability of the movement to get into the streets, to have to mobilise in communities, to have protests, to put pressure on through all the different means that we can, will be absolutely vital, I think, because otherwise I don't see that even the best Labour leadership, just on their own, will be able to make the kind of break that's necessary. So in order to do that, I think there's just two immediate priorities. One is, I think, the Palestine demonstration on May the 11th is absolutely critical. I mean, Britain has the best tradition, the best record anywhere in the world outside of the Middle East of supporting the Palestinian people. I mean, there's nowhere that has demonstrations of 150,000, 200,000 like we have had in the last 10 years in support of the Palestinians. This is it's an alliance between the Muslims, the left, the trade unions, that doesn't exist really anywhere else. It's an alliance the Israelis know about. They are desperate to smash. It's one of the reasons why there's been this huge exaggerated campaign over anti-Semitism, partly against Jeremy, partly against people standing up for Palestine. I think it's absolutely critical that we have a big turnout for that demonstration on May the 11th, because we need to start pulling together that alliance again. We don't want to go back to a period where it was just a few thousand, you know, sort of hardy Palestine experts and specialists who came out on that. That needs to be a real mass demonstration of the whole of the movement, and I think it's very important we get Labour bodies on board. I'm very pleased to say Momentum has backed the demo today, which is fantastic. Owen Jones is speaking on the demonstration he's just announced, which is great. You know, we need to make sure this is a serious mobilisation. I'm very keen on there being a coach from Newcastle. I think we need to make it big. The last thing is, in December, Donald Trump is coming to London, fantastic, for the NATO conference. So actually, this does give us the possibility of popularising the anti-NATO arguments. And we're discussing with people at the moment, can we have the anti-Trump demo? Obviously, we had 250,000 people in June last year. We want to get another massive demonstration, but we want it to have No to NATO as one of its components. And if we can do that, the whole process of building for it can be an educative process where we kind of get people to understand that, you know, actually NATO is part of the problem here. NATO is you know, a toxic network that is designed to promote and defend this kind of foreign policy that has caused so much damage around the world. So those seem to me to be two priorities. I know there's lots going on. I know politics is in a weird old state. But actually, if we can have a big Palestine demonstration on May the 11th, and in December, a huge showing against Trump, I think those two things can do quite a lot to helping to rebuild the left and give people more confidence and combativity. So thanks.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for explaining.